Today on Against the Grain. Billions of dollars have been spent on Alzheimer's research over many decades, yet no effective treatment exists. Investigative journalist Charles Piller has revealed one reason for the impasse. Pivotal scientific research into Alzheimer's disease, affirming the hypothesis that it's caused by sticky amyloid plaques in the brain, was based on manipulated images. From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. Alzheimer's is a devastating disease that robs people of their memories and ultimately their sense of self. It affects millions of people in this country and tens of millions around the world, and those numbers are projected to double by 2050. Award-winning journalist Charles Piller writes for Science Magazine. Over the last several years, he's helped uncover the manipulation of data in Alzheimer's research, with terrible repercussions for understanding a disease with no viable treatments. He details that story in his book, Doctored: Fraud, Arrogance, and Tragedy in the Quest to Cure Alzheimer's. Charles, can you explain for us what the prevailing hypothesis is for how Alzheimer's affects the brain?
The prevailing hypothesis is something called the amyloid hypothesis of Alzheimer's. And I think listeners might remember the term sticky plaques that has been associated with that way of thinking. This hypothesis suggests that the accumulation of a particular protein called amyloid beta in the brain leads to a cascade of biochemical effects that ultimately causes the death of some brain cells and leads to Alzheimer's dementia.
Can you give us a rough sense of how much money has been poured into Alzheimer's research in recent decades?
Sure. Actually, I think it would be most understandable, if you don't mind, if I go back to the beginning very briefly. So the Alzheimer's was discovered by a guy by the name of Alois Alzheimer, who was a German doctor back in 1906. And it was based on observations of a patient with dementia who, after she died, he did an autopsy and found two characteristics in her brain. One is the amyloid protein accumulation that I mentioned, and the other is something that is now called tau, and it's a kind of also a kind of accumulation inside the brain cells, something that is referred to as tangles because of its tangled string tangle-like shape. And these characteristics were noted, and they were described in the scientific literature and discussed, and the disease was named after Alzheimer, but not that much attention was paid to it for many decades. And the reason is very much a reason having to do with age demographics. It wasn't until decades later that lifespans began to be routinely extended into much older ages. So today, of course, in our society, most people who live past infancy live a pretty long time, and our life expectancies are into the 70s and 80s, the period of time when Alzheimer's symptoms become most prevalent. And consequently, a lot of money was poured into it. So just to answer your question directly, starting in the 70s and 80s, the government started to pour enormous sums of money, gradually increasing, into this Alzheimer's mystery. And it's amounted from both federal expenditures and funders from private sector and also, of course, drug companies doing their own drug development into the many billions of dollars over the decades.
And yet, with those many billions of dollars, are we any closer to an effective treatment for Alzheimer's at this point?
In a sense, it depends on what you describe as effective. So, this amyloid hypothesis of the disease has received the lion's share of funding associated with trying to find treatments and cures for Alzheimer's. And notwithstanding billions spent on it, it went through a period, a long period of basically failure after failure of drugs that were designed to attack amyloids and flush them out of the brain. Even though these drugs were quite successful at doing that, they were unsuccessful at arresting the symptoms of Alzheimer's or reversing them, or obviously not curing the disease either. So it's been very, very disappointing. Now, more recently, there have been a few drugs that have been approved by the Food and Drug Administration that have shown what they call a statistically significant slowing in the rate of cognitive decline in Alzheimer's patients. So what that means is that the symptoms of cognitive decline have not been arrested. People are still getting worse day by day, but at a slightly slower pace than people who were given a placebo for these drugs that were tested. And so I need to put that in perspective, because this change in the rate of decline was so small that many neurologists and neuroscientists say that it would be imperceptible to those patients, their families, or caregivers. So consequently, if you could call this a success, as many people in the industry have done, you have to put it in perspective. It's at best an extremely minimal success, and one that might not be even appreciated by the people taking the drug.
And which come with pretty significant side effects.
Exactly right. The side effects are brain swelling and bleeding for the most part. And this can be at times very serious and even can be cause fatal complications. So what you have is a risk-benefit ratio that has to be measured if anyone's thinking about taking these drugs. And let me make it clear, I'm not a doctor. I'm not advising people never take these drugs. That's a decision that each patient and their physician and their family members should discuss. But they should be aware that there are significant and sometimes fatal risks associated with these drugs for what I think everyone would agree is, at best, a very minimal benefit.
Indeed, and also a very high price tag on those drugs. I wonder if you can tell us the story of a drug developed by Cassava Sciences, simufilam, that purported to treat Alzheimer's, and how you connect, how that story connected you to a Vanderbilt neuroscientist called Matthew Schrag.
That's a pretty interesting tale. Simufilam was a drug that is a drug that has been studied by Cassava Sciences for a long time. And back in 2021, it was challenged in something called a citizen petition to the Food and Drug Administration. And this petition, written by some neuroscientists who were also, just to make it clear, were something called short sellers in the company stock. So they were people who were hoping to profit if the share price went down. But they were also qualified experts in the field, challenged the basic science behind this drug, simufilam. And when I say basic science, what I mean is the laboratory studies that established the likelihood that it might be a valuable drug to test in people for Alzheimer's disease. And this petition detailed some of the problems. Now, a person behind the scenes in filing this petition, but who was not named at the time, a guy by the name of Matthew Schrag, who you mentioned, a scientist at Vanderbilt University, who was working, you could say, in his own spare time, not associated with his work as a professor there, to examine the studies behind simufilam. And he discovered that there were dozens of problems in many of the studies associated with this drug that called into question the veracity of the studies, because they seemed to contain a lot of doctored images. That means images that appeared to have been altered improperly to support the hypothesis of the experiment.
Can you tell us about the Western blot gels, how they're used in this research, and how images of them can be manipulated or changed?
There are many kinds of images that can be manipulated improperly in scientific experiments. The two that are the most important for Alzheimer's are the ones that have apparently been manipulated in many studies, are something called micrographs, which are highly magnified versions of tissues such as brain tissue from mice or even from people. And the second is what you mentioned, Western blots. And this is the technique used by scientists, that's a physical technique that's used to separate proteins in a tissue sample by molecular weight. And so molecular weight meaning shows kind of the composition by weight of the different kinds of proteins that exist in a particular sample. And then they are photographically changed into a image that shows what look like a pattern of stacked bars, kind of like a ladder pattern of stacked bars that reflect both the amount and the kind of proteins that are found in the sample. This is very, very important because a lot of the study of Alzheimer's has to do with measuring and understanding the relationship of particular proteins to the disease, including the different forms of amyloid beta protein, they call it.
Can you explain the way that money is awarded to research? So taking the case of simufilam, when the research initially turned up nothing much in terms of how significant the drug was on affecting people who were suffering from Alzheimer's. And then when these manipulated images were released, how the fortunes of the company, Cassava Sciences, changed, at least for a short while.
Cassava is a very interesting example because I think in my mind it shows the complacency of a lot of institutional authorities that even though these authorities often do stellar work in both funding and development of drugs and in their oversight of that, there's some weak spots. And this is one that exposed a lot of those from the federal agencies that are involved, as well as the universities and the journals that are kind of the overseers and gatekeepers of scientific knowledge. So what happened after the citizen petition was filed that I mentioned, Matthew Schrag, who at this point, again, was not known to be involved in that. He was not known until after I wrote about his involvement many months later. But he also delivered to the National Institutes of Health a 100-page dossier on the work by a particular scientist by the name of Huyan Wang at City University of New York, who was a principal collaborator with Cassava on the development of simufilam. And this was a pretty intense, pretty well-documented set of complaints and concerns suggesting that there may have been rampant manipulation in these studies. But the process of evaluating them went very, very, very slowly. And in the meantime, Cassava was, even after the announcement of the problems in the citizen petition that was made public, even though their stock plummeted at that point, it did regain its value because of statements made by the company about what they called very favorable results from different experiments that they were doing. So it was kind of an up and down seesaw effect of their stock. When bad news would come out, the stock would drop. But then when they made favorable statements, it would go up. And in the meantime, they're raising enormous amounts of money based on these claims about the promising nature of simufilam from investors and shareholders. And, you know, if I could add a couple of different facts here that to me were pretty interesting. One is that the City University of New York, the employer of Professor Wang, they did an internal investigation of his work on the basic science behind simufilam and found that he engaged in egregious misconduct. But the report wasn't released until it was leaked to me well after it was finalized by the university. For reasons that have never been made clear, they never released the report. But when it was leaked to me, I made it public and I posted the report on the Science website. But even after this report was filed and was made public, the university took no action on Professor Wang. Instead, they mounted an effort to find the person who had leaked the report to me and spending considerable sums of money on it. That person's name has never been revealed publicly, I might add. Meanwhile, the FDA, knowing that the university had found that Dr. Wong's work, which was integral to the work done by Cassava on simufilum, they took no action. I might add that FDA itself inspected Dr. Wong's lab when he was investigating results for the clinical experiments for this drug, not the basic science, just lab science, but these were tests with people, and he was testing samples of blood and spinal fluid in order to see if the drug was effective in finding and reducing the presence of biomarkers, they call them, which are signs of Alzheimer's disease in the brain. And what he found was unfortunately found by FDA to be based on lab techniques that were grossly inadequate. This was explicit in the FDA report that was written, that it was again leaked to me and that I posted online. And still, the agency took no action. They didn't intervene in any way, even though they knew now, one, that there was reason to believe that there had been misconduct associated with this work. Two, that their own inspectors found really terrible failings in the Wong lab associated with simufilum testing. Finally, a lot of stuff happened in the last year about this drug. One is that the company acknowledged that it had cherry-picked data associated with the results of a trial in people, clinical trial, and that it represented the effects of the drug quite favorably when they couldn't be well supported in that way. Second, the Department of Justice charged Professor Wong with fraud associated with his grants involving Cassava Sciences' work on simufilum. It's very unusual for the Department of Justice to actually charge a scientist with fraud in this context. And the Securities and Exchange Commission settled with Cassava and also with Wong and a couple of the executives at Cassava for having done things that were improper related to possible financial law violations. And the company paid the SEC $40 million to settle those claims. Still, in the light of all this, the FDA took no action. They allowed the trials to continue. They allowed human testing to continue with this very suspect drug. And finally, what happened is the drug failed, as everyone expected it would. Last fall, the company announced that the clinical trials had failed and they were no longer testing simufilum for Alzheimer's disease. So the reason I gave all this detail and provided all these examples of junctures where the federal agency FDA could have stepped in and didn't is that it seems so puzzling to me that in the light of apparent misconduct, in the light of settlement with the SEC, in the light of charges of fraud, in the light of the FDA's own inspectors finding terrible irregularities in the testing of clinical samples, the agency did nothing. They just allowed the trial to continue and, to my eye, exploit patients who were involved.
I'm speaking with investigative journalist Charles Piller. He's the author of Doctored: Fraud, Arrogance, and Tragedy in the Quest to Cure Alzheimer's. I'm Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Well, we'll loop around back to that question of why entities like the FDA have looked away in many ways from the repercussions of misdeeds in Alzheimer's research. But I wanted to ask you about research that was published in 2006 in the prestigious journal Nature by neuroscientists from the University of Minnesota about a key mechanism of Alzheimer's disease. So going back now several decades, what did the research purport to find?
Let me first set the stage very briefly. By 2006, so this was the 100-year anniversary of the discovery of Alzheimer's disease. And by that time, there had been a number of treatments developed that, again, removed this amyloid protein from the brain and yet had no beneficial effect on cognition. So there was a lot of discouragement about the possibility that the amyloid hypothesis was either overstated or perhaps incorrect, and skepticism had begun to arise in the scientific community about whether all of this effort, all of these millions and billions of dollars being spent on the amyloid hypothesis might have been not really the best direction, and there should be other ideas explored more fully. Then in 2006, the experiment that you mentioned was published in this very important journal, Nature. And the experiment was very clever. Scientists from the University of Minnesota and with collaborators in other locations did something involving a genetically engineered mouse that produces copious volumes of amyloid proteins, and these get deposited in the mouse's brain. And what the scientists did is they extracted some of this protein and purified one element of it, something called amyloid beta star 56. And people might remember that I mentioned that the Western blot test tests the proteins and divides them by molecular weight. Well, this was a kind of a heavyweight, you might say, protein star 56, kind of a catchy name that I think added to its luster after the experiment. And the star 56 protein was then injected into rats, who then began to show the symptoms of memory loss that are identified with Alzheimer's disease in people. And so the results of the experiment, according to the experimenters, were that this was the first substance ever found in experimentation that showed a specific amyloid beta protein had a cause and effect relationship with memory loss. And so it was a kind of a breakthrough. Because it was published in a prestigious journal, because it showed such a clear result, it became sort of one of the most important and most highly cited papers in many years in Alzheimer's research. Thousands of citations, thousands of other scientists, and really important scientists using the results of that experiment to support their own ideas about the amyloid hypothesis and to support their own work. So what happened was that Matthew Schrag, who the scientist at Vanderbilt University, who was one of the people who closely examined the drug simufilam and the science behind it, he and I became connected in December 2021, talking initially about cassava sciences and simufilam. And he was testing out some techniques in how he was able to understand the way in which to examine scientific image for possible image doctoring. And he didn't want to just concentrate fully on simufilam and cassava sciences work. And the reason for that was that he didn't want to introduce a kind of expectation in his own mind that he would, you know, automatically be looking for flaws in those experiments or problems in those experiments. He wanted to look at other things in the public record to be able to test out his techniques. And one that he found was a study by this guy at the University of Minnesota called Sylvain Lesnay, a French scientist who was working at that university. And he saw that this experiment by Lesnay had been posted on a website called PubPeer that is used by scientists and all kinds of other people to ask questions about possible flaws or other doubts about experimental findings or images in experiments. And he thought, this is somewhat compelling evidence to suggest that images might have been doctored. He decided to take a closer look at this guy, Lesnay, from the University of Minnesota. And as he looked, he found this important experiment, this seminal experiment in the history of Alzheimer's disease, the one we were just talking about in Nature. And he started to look carefully at the images in this experiment and very quickly saw that there seemed to be strong evidence of image doctoring in this very critical, influential experiment. And he looked further and further and saw several images within that study that looked pretty obviously to him and others to be based on image doctoring, calling into question the experimental findings.
How significant then was that revelation that the images were doctored in this key publication for shaking the foundations of the amyloid hypothesis? Was it, as some supporters of the hypothesis argued, not necessarily enough to condemn the whole thing? Others argued that it was. How did you make sense of that?
The way I made sense of it was that my journalistic technique is that I would vet these findings very carefully, both with other forensic image experts and also with some of the top experts in the field, and ask them the kind of questions that you're asking me. Part of the issue is to not just understand whether his findings about these images were believable and strong, but also what the meaningfulness of these findings were. And so in my view, and I think in the view of most people who are skeptical of the amyloid hypothesis, amyloid proteins have something to do with Alzheimer's. They're just too present in the history of the disease to have nothing to do with it. They are obviously associated with Alzheimer's. The question really is, are they the driver? Are they the driver of the disease? And while this is a controversial issue, it has, again, it's been the prevalent hypothesis, and even still today, the most important, most dominant way of looking at the disease. So what happened when I wrote an article in Science Magazine about the effects of this research by Matthew Schrag in examining this important study in Nature? There was an immediate, gigantic response from the community of scientists studying the disease. It was also covered pretty broadly in the media globally, because it was such an important development in understanding Alzheimer's. But what the community of people who are studying the disease broke into pretty much two camps. One camp were people who said, this is outrageous. This has shown that a lot of the effort in the disease was misspent, and that the field needs to take a good hard look in the mirror and ask themselves, do we need to broaden our horizons? Do we need to stop going in lockstep with the acolytes of this hypothesis and to start to think more independently and creatively about how to manage Alzheimer's? The other side were people whose careers, fortunes, and their entire legacy was bound up in proving the truth of the amyloid hypothesis. And many of them said things like, oh, well, we never believed this old experiment anyway, and it really doesn't have much effect on our thinking or on the course of the disease or on the other research that's been done, even though those same people had many, many times cited this study that Professor Lesnay and his mentor Karen Ash at the University of Minnesota were the leaders of, had cited it as vitally important to their own thinking in the field and their own support for the amyloid hypothesis. So my view is that this one study didn't prove or disprove the hypothesis per se, but it raised a gigantic question about whether the central focus, the, some would say, almost singular focus in mainstream ideas about science, was really a kind of groupthink that needed to be re-examined by the professionals in the field.
How did the paper that was published in Nature that you've been discussing come to be retracted in 2024, said to be the second most highly cited paper ever retracted?
Yes, it was indeed the second most highly cited ever. So this paper went through a thorough review after my story in Science appeared publicly. The journal Nature started to examine the findings by Professor Schrag, and after a couple years of examination, and you have to understand that this is one of the most frustrating, exasperating elements of this process, is that many journals take many months or years to review the possibility of doctored research, even though the evidence might be quite strong. But ultimately, the study was retracted, and I might add that Karen Ash, who was Sylvain Lesnay's mentor and was the kind of leading author on the study, in the way scientific studies work, the first listed author and the last are the two most important for the study. and Lesney was the first and Ash the last as kind of the supervising scientist. And all of the authors of the study except Lesney, who weighed in, agreed that the study should be retracted because of improper image manipulation. So finally, after 2 years, the study was agreed to have been improperly done.
How aggressively do journals, scientific journals like Nature, take stock of the images and the research of prospective authors in the discussion of simufilam, the Alzheimer's drug which you were mentioning earlier, a product of Cassava Sciences, the research that was published on that, the author who worked for Cassava Sciences referenced his own work as the evidence that certain models of testing things was valid, which, you know, is circular. To what degree do journals look at such things?
I would say that I have a very high respect for scholarly journals, not every scholarly journal, but many of them. Of course, I work for a publication called Science, which is a leading scholarly journal. And even though I work for the journalism side of the book, it's a little bit different. But obviously, I have a great respect for a lot of the studies that they publish and for their rigor in evaluating them. So these journals use something called peer review to assess the meaningfulness and truthfulness of studies. But even though that's an important process and is very valuable, it's not foolproof. Part of the reason why is that journals, until recently, haven't paid close attention to the possibility that people were submitting doctored images with their studies. Consequently, a lot of stuff slipped through and polluted the scientific literature in the process, often sending thinking in wrong directions because it was based on unsupported science. So that's a big problem, partly because peer reviewers aren't trained and asked to look for possible image doctoring. The journals themselves are just now, many of them, just now beginning, when I say just now, I mean in the last few years, have started to get serious about examining images using AI software and to some degree human beings to actually look these things over and try to ensure that they're not based on improprieties or possible image doctoring. They're not doing a good enough job, I'm afraid, and it's partly because it's a very tough job, but partly because they haven't made it as much of a priority as it needs to be, and as a result, it's a big problem in the scientific literature that I think deserves and requires more attention.
I'm Sasha Lilly. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio, and I'm speaking with Charles Piller, author of Doctored: Fraud, Arrogance, and Tragedy in the Quest to Cure Alzheimer's. And Charles, we've mainly been discussing the fraudulent work of scientists. So I wanted to turn to the pharmaceutical companies that are often partnered with such scientists or even are their employers.
Yeah, it's a complicated question, Sasha. I find fault with the drug companies for many things. I would say by and large, however, image doctoring per se is somewhat less of an issue in industry than it is in academia. And there's a lot of logical reasons for that. But just to be clear, these companies are in the business of making money, and their data are scrutinized by regulators before drugs can come to market. And consequently, there is a little bit higher degree of scrutiny than on many of the papers that end up in scholarly journals. Also, there's a huge liability question for drug makers. If they're knowingly producing drugs based on doctored data, they open up themselves to an enormous legal liability. So this is not to say that that doesn't go on in industry. Of course it does. But I would say that a lot of the problems, like what I described with regard to Cassava Sciences, were these collaborations between a company and a scientist at a university where things really went off the rails. There are other issues with drug companies that I think are pretty interesting and are not specifically related to image doctoring per se, but still are worth mentioning. I talked earlier about the drugs that have been recently approved for Alzheimer's disease. These are antibody drugs. By antibodies, I'm referring to our immune system creates antibodies to attack viruses or bacteria, things that are infecting us, such as COVID or common cold or much worse diseases than that. And the antibodies that are used as drugs are often lab-created that are meant to attack a particular insult to the body. In this case, lab-created antibodies that try to attack and sweep out these amyloid proteins from the brain. And they've been very successful, as I mentioned, at doing that. The drug companies have been getting these drugs approved by FDA in part because of their close relationship to the agency. People may not realize that when the FDA evaluates drugs, the way it works is that they are paid user fees by the companies to do these evaluations. So it creates a kind of inherent conflict of interest. The people paying for the research by FDA to assess a drug are the ones who really want the agency to approve it. The other aspect to that potential conflict is that agency officials often go through what is widely known as the revolving door, where they might evaluate drugs from a particular company or in a particular industry, and then after these evaluations are completed, often favorably, go to that industry and take employment where they might double, triple, quadruple their salaries that they were earning with the federal government. And so this revolving door, combined with the fact that the companies pay user fees to evaluate their drugs, creates a kind of complicated set of conflicts of interest. They're not the only ones, I might add. Usually the FDA on big, important drugs will create advisory committees that will assist the agency in assessing the company supplied data to see if these drugs are worthy of approval and therefore being marketed and sold to the public. What has happened in the case of these anti-amyloid antibodies is that there was a very controversial example of the first of these that was approved by FDA, a drug that was marketed under the name Aduhelm. The advisory committee almost unanimously said this drug is too dangerous and too ineffective to approve for use by the public, and you should not approve it. But the agency went ahead and approved it anyway and disregarded the advice of their independent expert panel. This was very disturbing to many people in the medical community. And what ultimately happened is that this drug was removed from the market by the company that developed it, Biogen. And the reason they removed it is that it wasn't selling well. It wasn't effective because of the potential dangers and because of its lack of relative effectiveness to really do much for the disease. But the agency then built a new advisory committee for the next drug that was going to be evaluated for possible marketing and sale. That drug was called lecanemab. Now it's being marketed under the name Leqembi, and it's a big development in the industry. And this was a case where the new advisory committee was composed of scientists who were much more sympathetic to this idea of the amyloid hypothesis, to this idea of using lecanemab, now known as Leqembi, as a solution to that problem, and in many cases had financial conflicts that were associated with the developers of that drug. So that combination of factors resulted in a very favorable assessment by the advisory committee. Now, one could ask the question, was this a genuinely independent advisory committee? And something that I look at very closely in my book, Doctored, is how good of a job does the FDA do in these assessments for Alzheimer's disease? Again, I want to emphasize that we are lucky in this country to have an important agency like the FDA that by and large does amazing work in helping us have a fairly good food and drug supply and evaluation system, much better than in many other parts of the world. But there are weaknesses, and this is one of them, having to do with conflicts of interest and having to do with assessments of controversial drugs like lecanemab and Aduhelm.
In your book, Doctor, you talk about something that you call the amyloid mafia. I wonder if you could explain what you mean there, that have successfully really kept the amyloid hypothesis as the central focus of research for Alzheimer's disease.
The amyloid mafia, let me be clear, that's a metaphor. There is no actual criminal organization, certainly not. And it's just a way of describing a phenomenon in the field. And, you know, the people who are supporters and boosters of the amyloid hypothesis are among the most powerful and influential scientists in the world. And they are illustrious scientists in many cases who have done really interesting work on Alzheimer's disease. And these are folks who have genuinely, many of them, contributed to our understanding. The problem is that many of these people have spent their entire career trying to prove the importance, veracity, and dominance of this way of thinking about the disease, and have been very successful in promoting it as the be-all, end-all of thinking about Alzheimer's disease. So this has taken a few different forms, but part of it is mind share in the scientific world. When you have one really widely accepted way of thinking, the conventional wisdom can be extremely powerful, and it skews the way in which journals, funders, and regulators think about how should we go about solving this problem of Alzheimer's. When you have an enormous number of studies, an enormous number of talks at open conferences, when you have incremental findings of this element of the hypothesis and that element of the hypothesis that seem to suggest its importance, you create a kind of gravitational field that seems to attract more and more attention and money to the exclusion of other ideas. So people who have other notions about how Alzheimer's might be attacked and approached, they found themselves on the outside and having difficulty getting funding, having difficulty swaying other people in the field, and realizing that if they were going to survive as scientists in Alzheimer's disease, they had to some degree, pay homage to the amyloid hypothesis because of the great power of the influencers behind it.
Well, and of course, this raises a question about how effective science is in correcting these wrong directions when a certain hypothesis takes hold and there are all sorts of investments in it, some financial, some intellectual, or someone's legacy. It really does give us pause, those of us who are not scientists and have an assumption that science somehow manages to be above all of this. And I wondered if you have a sense of whether this kind of both sort of dogmatic thinking and more, and then of course the kind of fraud which has in this case bolstered it, is more widespread in drug research beyond Alzheimer's, especially given the enormous stakes and incentives connected to it?
Yeah, that's a terrific question, Sasha. Thank you. I would say, first of all, if I could just address the question of self-correction, the beauty of science, the beauty of how the scientific method operates, it is an incredibly important and wonderful thing in society. And one element of it is that, you know, false information is not going to be successful ultimately. You can't cure a disease with doctored images. It just isn't going to happen. That's the ultimate result. But the problem is that if an idea gains a lot of currency and is widely supported, and there's a lot of sunk costs into it, billions of dollars, in fact, in sunk costs by government and industry, then it can be very difficult to dislodge people, no matter what litany of failure you see in experiment after experiment, when people try to use it as a way of curing a disease. So it can take a very long time, and in the process, it can derail or delay other possibly fruitful ways of thinking about a disease like Alzheimer's. So to address your question directly of how widespread is the problem of image doctoring or possible fraud, possible misconduct in all kinds of science, not just in Alzheimer's disease, let me make it clear that I think that the vast majority of scientists in Alzheimer's and in other fields are completely honest people with integrity who are deeply determined to solve scientific problems in an honest way. And I would say that scientists are people, no more or less than people in any other walk of life. There are scientists who are dishonest and cut corners and even engage in fraud. Unfortunately, even a relatively small number of those people, if they're influential, if they are in influential positions, as my book shows some have been, they can cause great damage in scientific thinking in a field. They can skew thinking. They can create a gravitational field, as I mentioned, into a certain way of operating and way of thinking that can deter other people from doing important work. So I would say from my observation and from studies that others have done, this phenomenon of possible or actual image doctoring is widespread in science as a whole. And it's widespread, again, at a relatively very small amount compared to the vast number of very correct work with great integrity, but unfortunately enough to be problematic in a variety of scientific fields. But I want to say specifically that Alzheimer's is a little bit different from some of the other ones in this way. Alzheimer's is a disease, unlike heart disease, cancer, stroke, a lot of the big killers, that has not had an important breakthrough. There's never been a remedy that has arrested or reversed the symptoms of Alzheimer's disease. And that is not just a tragedy for patients, but it's also a tragedy for the scientific process that I think shows that improprieties, possible image doctoring, possible fraud, certainly evidence of widespread evidence of image doctoring in the scientific literature, shows that it could have been much more tragic in Alzheimer's disease, because unlike these other great important diseases that have been attacked by a number of different approaches, medical, healthy lifestyles, radiation, etc., there's just been nothing similar for Alzheimer's disease so far. And I would just say that means that the problem of misconduct in Alzheimer's research is perhaps more important than in some of these other fields.
Well, let me end with precisely the implications of what you've just raised. Even with the billions of dollars that have gone into Alzheimer's research, research validating the amyloid hypothesis obviously has been funded at the expense of other hypotheses. And given the questions that have been raised about whether that's a very shaky foundation for a hypothesis, do you have a sense of whether there have been or are potentially promising avenues of research into Alzheimer's disease that have been sidelined because of this single-minded focus on the amyloid hypothesis and whatever has been used to bolster it?
Yeah, thank you for asking that, Sasha. I think there are reasons for optimism and hope. You know, science is vast, and even though this has been the dominant way of thinking about Alzheimer's disease for decades, it hasn't been to the complete exclusion of other ideas which have some potential. One is there have been some interesting experiments that, you know, maybe are years away from fruition, but might have some benefits associated with the tau proteins I mentioned earlier. These are the kind of tangles that are described inside brain cells. Some work, perhaps eventually fruitful work, could attack that problem. Second, there's been some really fascinating work being done with GLP-1 inhibitors. These are the drugs developed for obesity that have been sweeping the scientific community in the last few years and have been with very successful for obesity and some other conditions. They've been used also for diabetes. And there's some thinking and some clinical trials going on that they might be beneficial for reducing cognitive decline in Alzheimer's. And I don't know if that's true, but we're going to find out in the next year or two about that. The other area of research that I find fascinating and potentially influential is the so-called infection hypothesis of Alzheimer's disease. The idea that latent infections, such as herpes, which can cause lesions on the body but goes away, that virus is well known to sometimes hide out in organs of the body, including the brain, for many, many years after the infection seems to have been completely subsided. And there's a clinical trial going on right now about whether attacking the herpes virus, the latent herpes virus, might also have a beneficial effect on people suffering from early Alzheimer's. So these are not the only examples, but these are some of the important ones that, in my view, are so interesting and could also offer alternatives to being in lockstep with this one idea that there's only one way to go and cure the disease. If I could leave listeners with one small additional thought, I think people should understand that we have agency as people about this, even about Alzheimer's disease. There is no magic bullet about Alzheimer's disease. There's no lifestyle or nutritional supplement or magic cure for preventing Alzheimer's or curing it. And so I'm not in any way suggesting that. But there are risk factors for the disease: high blood pressure, high cholesterol levels, unhealthful diets, a lack of exercise. These are things that we can all have some degree of control over in our lives. And I just encourage people to think carefully about living your best, most healthful life, not just for the possibility that it can forestall the worst effects of Alzheimer's should you be unlucky enough in old age to have that disease, but also just to live a better life in general and to enjoy your life to its fullest.
Charles, thank you so much.
I'm so glad that you asked these questions, Sasha, and I very much appreciate the opportunity.
I've been speaking with investigative journalist Charles Piller. He writes for Science Magazine. We've been discussing Doctored: Fraud, Arrogance, and Tragedy in the Quest to Cure Alzheimer's. You can find a link to that book at againstthegrain.org. You've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks so much for listening, and please tune in again next time.